This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Hi, this is Andrew Austin, and you're listening to the Impact Outdoors podcast. Yeah, I've been pretty busy the past year on social media. There's a lot of pressure in the kind of the social media wildlife community to post a lot and to try to get as many followers as possible. And I kind of felt that pressure. And so I started posting all these reels and stuff. And, you know, my goal is always to spread a message of conservation and inspire people to get outside and learn about their local wildlife. But it's funny, I had some success on social media posting videos and stuff. And You start to get addicted to that viral, the viral stuff, and I had to check myself because I never want to get sucked into that vanity, you know.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode here at Impact Outdoors Podcast, and on this episode we've got to sit down with my good friend Andrew Austin, otherwise known as the Texas Naturalist on social media, and also hosts his podcast, The Wildlife Experience, which is a great dive into interviewing some great people working in the outdoors and the conservation arena, and just had a really good talk with Andrew from herping into photography, videography, getting to work on Deep in the Heart, how I got into podcasting, and a bunch of other topics that we covered. So I know you're going to really enjoy this one. So let's jump right into this week's show with Andrew Austin. I am super excited. We've been trying to get together and do this podcast for, I would say, over 2 years now.
Like it.
But I've got my good friend, Mr. Andrew Austin, on the show with us today. Welcome, Andrew. How are you doing, man?
Great to be here, man. Doing well here in the duck call shop currently.
Yeah, that's what you were saying. You're surrounded by duck calls, or what's left after the Christmas rush. So
I get better service here, internet service. So it's always more reliable just to stay here if I'm going to do a podcast. So
nice. So, yeah, I hear you.
Talking on my end.
Well, it's good to see you. We met a couple years ago through our mutual friend, Mr. Chester Moore, and you've been coming and hanging out with us and being a big part of the Hunt Fish Podcast Summit up at the Warren Ranch every year. And we've gotten to know each other a little bit over that. I know from following you on Instagram and stuff, and you were outside as much as possible. I'm very jealous that I'm not out as much as you are. And you're probably like, well, I'm not out that much, but, you do a lot of cool stuff. And, I really, really enjoy your podcasts and what you're doing. You have a very unique approach to things from your outlook, maybe not necessarily a biological standpoint, but from a conservationist standpoint and kind of some of your views that have changed over the years and stuff. And so I wanted to have you on to kind of talk about some of your passions and what you're doing there with SureShot and stuff. So why don't you give us a little background on Andrew and we'll see where this goes.
Yeah, man. And thanks again for having me. I'm from Beaumont, Texas, actually a small town outside of Beaumont called Finette. Very, very important to know that. Finette is not Beaumont. But most people know Beaumont, small little town in southeast Texas. Grew up a pretty passionate outdoorsman and naturalist. Was always pretty determined to be a wildlife biologist from the time I was pretty young. And eventually I made it to A&M, got my degree in wildlife ecology and conservation. Worked at various wildlife facilities, working a lot with alligators and crocodiles. Went down to Belize. On an internship, worked with crocs there doing research for a summer, worked at gator country, crocodile encounter, different stuff like that. But I soon realized I belong in the field. So the zoo stuff wasn't really for me, but, yeah, eventually I ended up in the consulting field doing wetland and endangered species surveys, did that for a couple of years. And now I'm at SureShot Game Calls, kind of took a little bit of a detour outside of standard, you know, wildlife biology. But I'm very lucky, you know, in my job here, I still get to pursue wildlife biology. I have great connections and great mentors and friends that keep me in the loop, keep me connected to conservation and research. And when I'm not out doing that, you know, I'm out doing wildlife photography, duck hunting, bass fishing, fly fishing, birding, basically anything that has to do with the outdoors and wildlife. And it's been great, man. I thoroughly enjoy my life and I've been very lucky so far.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I remember, like, I know you do a lot of herpetology stuff, you know, big herper and stuff. And I really got into that when I was in college, with my degree at Oklahoma State, and we had a really good herpetology class up there. And next time we're together, I'm going to bring my book and show you a bunch of the stuff that we collected up there. I've got tons of pictures of some cool critters we caught up in Oklahoma. But man, Oklahoma. I miss the times of going and turning over rocks and looking for snakes and all kinds of lizards and stuff and salamanders and all that cool stuff. And 99% of that stuff people will never see.
Yeah.
It's crazy the amount of species diversity that exists.
Yeah. It helps you really appreciate, you know, wildlife as a whole. And I think most hunters and fishermen would enjoy it if they could get over the fear of the snakes and stuff, but it's an activity that, you know, you're just going out in the outdoors and you're looking for something and you get to see so much cool stuff. Mm-hmm. And the success rate is usually pretty high.
And I've
taken out some of my hunting buddies before and they always, you know, throughout my childhood and stuff, and they thought it was super cool going out herping.
Yeah. Anyway. My kids are finding that the more time we spend up at our deer lease up in the hill country and going and trouncing through the woods and flipping over rocks and looking for stuff. And we had a flurry of black widows up there this year, and I've never seen so many, but I mean, they were everywhere. And so my boy's not even scared of them, you know, like most people would when they see one for the first time. If you've ever seen one, they are pretty intimidating, even though they're not huge. They are creepy looking and stuff, but he just tells everybody about them. It's a lot of fun. It's a good activity to do and stuff. And I enjoy watching and following all your videos and pictures and stuff. You post all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been pretty busy the past year on social media. There's a lot of pressure in the kind of the social media wildlife community to post a lot and to try to get as many followers as possible. And I kind of felt that pressure. And so I started posting all these reels and stuff. And, you know, my goal is always to spread a message of conservation and inspire people to get outside and learn about their local wildlife. Mm-hmm. But it's funny, I had some success on social media posting videos and stuff, and you start to get addicted to that viral, the viral stuff. And I had to check myself because I never want to get sucked into that vanity, you know?
Yeah. I try to, I've noticed that anytime I post anything about the shark stuff we do at work, Like those just go through the roof. Oh, yeah. I mean, just
I love sharks, man.
Instantly, just thousands and thousands of views of reels and stuff, and people asking questions and things like that, which is cool. Yeah, most people don't like over here. I mean, most people, like somebody the other day was just like, we have sharks in Galveston Bay, you know? And I'm like, yeah, there's sharks all the way up at Lake Houston Dam. I mean, we've tagged sharks over here that were like 200, 300 miles up the Mississippi River in like 2 weeks, you know? And it's like, these fish go anywhere they can get where there's food. And people just don't understand that or realize it. And like you said, they're not exposed to it. So they have no idea. So it's really cool to be able to educate people through social media, you know? Yeah. And,
social media is such a great tool. As much as I hate it because it's addicting and it's, you know, there are negative aspects to social media, but there's also many positive aspects. Us sitting here right now is because of social media. Mm-hmm. You know, it's connected so many like-minded people and has created avenues to reach broader audiences. Like lately I've been trying to minimize my use of it, just trying to keep my head in the real world as much as possible. But when spring comes around, I'll probably be back in it. Cause that's spring is my favorite time of year, really.
Yeah.
Everything wakes up and
hopefully it's not too far away. Cause it's already cold enough for me here in Texas. So
this
cold for like 40 over 40s right now. So
when we get a real cold front in January here in Southeast Texas, it helps me appreciate spring more. If we don't get a cold front, there's something about a seasonal change that makes me happy. And when we don't get the good cold snap, it's also, you know, for duck hunting, it's very important that we get these cold fronts. And I'm hopeful this weekend we'll see ducks coming down from up north. But I like the seasonal change, and I don't like the cold for too long, but I feel like it's a nice reset going into spring, get a nice little winter in January and February.
Yeah, and I know they're talking about potentially having some more of these polar vortexes or whatever coming down here at the end of this month, which I'm hoping does not happen. People who live here remember what happened in 2021, you know, and I think that was in February when we had that last big freeze. And how much did that affect wildlife, you think, over in your area as far as like what you're doing? Is like these big climate change temperature drops, you know, sudden drops and stuff, and do you think there's a lot of mortality on wildlife like there is with dealing with the fish, just with the drastic changes in their surroundings?
Just anecdotally, I had one of my friends, he was my old boss, he was finding some reptiles that had froze to death, like under boards and like, you know, little ground skinks and different like green anoles and maybe some smaller snakes that kind of got caught out in the open. They didn't get deep enough for that freeze. But I'd assume it didn't have a huge population level impact, but who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. We're dealing with the fishery side of stuff right now. At work and stuff, and they're going through the process of looking, you know, ways to manage, you know, what we're dealing with now with the population. I won't say crashes or anything, but just the decline in spotted sea trout and stuff. I mean, there's no shortage of redfish or anything, but spotted sea trout numbers are down up and down the coast, and so, you know, there's always going to be drama anytime there's any regulation changes and stuff, but you know, ultimately everybody wants what's best for the resource.
Right.
And, so it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. You know, I remember in 21, I mean, there was in Central Texas, like the biggest effect I seen was like on the exotics that we have. Yeah. I mean, there were so many like axis and I guess oddad and maybe in black buck and stuff that were dying. I remember just seeing pictures of just trailers just full of dead exotics that they, you know, it's like, what do they do?
It just goes to show that these animals, they aren't as well suited as a white-tailed deer to live here. they do well otherwise, but the native species, they prevail.
Yeah, I think white-tailed deer and bull sharks can probably live just about anywhere.
They're tough.
So
generalist.
Yep. So, but it's a, it kind of makes you think too. Is pretty cool that we can live in this state, particularly with the vast amount of species, both native and non-native, that we have here that thrive here and stuff. And it's pretty cool to see that. You know, growing up in Oklahoma, I was never exposed to any of that. You know, I didn't even know we had animals like that, you know, living here in the United States. It was all just white-tailed deer, turkey. Every once in a while you hear about somebody seeing a black bear. Now there's black bears everywhere in Oklahoma. I mean, they're coming into, you know, all parts of the state. And and I'm so proud now to look back and see what Oklahoma's producing, you know, with elk populations and pronghorn and mule deer. I mean, we pretty much have everything up there now.
I was out in, God, I wish I remember the name of this place. It was in East Oklahoma. It was a wildlife management area. Man, we're driving through there. It was in the kind of late summer, early fall, looking for snakes. And there was a herd of elk out there. It was like the foothills of the Ozarks.
Yeah, no, like either Kiamichi Mountains or southern Ozarks.
A little north of Kiamichi.
It'd be the Ozark Plateau
W. May or something.
Yeah, Cookson Wildlife Management Area. Yep.
Yeah, that's where we were. There was elk, and I never knew elk were found there.
Yeah,
I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah, those before those started moving, I guess they were coming in basically from Arkansas in that area. It was all down in southwest Oklahoma. That was the only place that really had any notable elk populations. And now we've got huntable elk populations on both sides of the state. And
wow.
And I remember up there, not to talk about Oklahoma forever, but the first year they opened black bear season up for archery up there, they had a quota of like 10 bears, I believe. And we'll have to double check with our friend Todd on this, but I believe it was like 10 bears, and you basically had to call in when you harvested one so they could shut down the season basically over social media or whatever, like to put down that the season was closed. And I mean, it was just like 2 hours or something like that, seemed like, and then it was over. And I don't know what the quotas are now up there, but I know it's a lot more than that. And
awesome, man. It's good to hear of a state doing well with some of those species.
Yep. So, growing up over there where you were, like, what was your reasons or motivations for wanting to get into the outdoors? Was it a parent, grandparent, just friends, or how did that come about for you in your journey?
Definitely my dad. He had me out in the woods from the time I could barely walk. He had a lot of public land. So he'd ride a bicycle in to some of these spots, and he'd put me on the little rail in front of his seat. Mm-hmm. He'd like hold me on there. We'd ride through the woods, ride down the trails, get to his bow hunting spots. And then he would strap me up in a tree stand next to him. He'd like strap me to the tree. My feet would be dangling. Probably. I mean, I don't know if it was safe or not, but I'm here today. So, but, those are some of my, you know, initial experiences. My dad was always very supportive of my interest. I had a natural curiosity for all things in nature, and snakes just really captivated me, and lizards and turtles. And, I was very lucky that he didn't discourage my interest in snakes. Because, you know, a lot of my buddies that I grew up with, their dads taught them to kill every snake they see.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess he kind of had a natural curiosity too. He didn't pursue herpetology or biology or any of that, but he always thought it was cool when we'd come across a copperhead or I remember we found a timber rattlesnake one time, and it was one of the coolest experiences. And he was just super as excited as me to find it. And he picked it up and all this. And I remember being so mad that he picked it up because he wasn't trained.
Right.
And the timber is it's a bad bite too. I mean, it's among the worst of the rattlesnakes.
They're big. But,
like many people in my generation, I was very lucky to, you know, turn on the TV and see Steve Irwin every day. And he really had a huge impact on a lot of people in that time. So the combination of, my dad and Steve Irwin and just an innate curiosity. I've always been that way, and it's still present in me. I still feel like a little kid curious about the world at the time.
That's cool. That's really cool. And so was the photography stuff and all that? Is that just kind of the natural progression of being outdoors?
Yeah, I think so. With hunting and fishing, the goal is to go out and harvest an animal or catch a fish. And that's what you get to bring home. You know, going out looking for snakes and other critters, for the longest time, I was happy just going out, catching them. Which when I was young, I would actually collect a lot of stuff, bring it home, keep it for a few days, and then release it. But as I got older, I didn't really like keeping the animals as much. You know, a lot of times in wild caught herps don't do well in captivity, and I was tired of seeing dead animals in my aquarium.
Don't tell the green anoles in my backyard that my kids catch 50 times a week. So.
I try to keep all these little rough green snakes and garter snakes and stuff, and they didn't always do too well. So I stopped collecting. When I'm out hunting for something, I want to bring something home. So eventually I got a camera, and that's what I was hunting. It was a photograph. Mm-hmm. And I'd have a list of species that I wanted to find. I wanted to find every species of snake in my home county here in Jefferson County. And that was kind of a way of cataloging everything. Take a picture of it. And then at some point, social media popped up when I was, I don't know, like 13 or 14, and kind of got on YouTube and Facebook and found some other weird snake people like me. And that's how I initially kind of started networking. And some of those, initial people I met ended up being people I worked for later on, after college, which is kind of wild, how I found that community of people, naturalists that also work in biology. But yeah, the photography stuff really, as Instagram grew and became more popular, the photography really became something that I pursued seriously. I've had a few photos and books and various things like that. But it's mostly just a hobby. I've never really done it for work. It's just a way to capture nature and to tell stories and to just help people understand just how cool their own backyard is.
Yeah. And it doesn't hurt now that you can actually take like magazine quality photos and stuff with this thing, with your phone that takes such good pictures now, and something everybody can do. And that's one of the things, like when I'm charter fishing and stuff, taking people out, it's like, I really try to get some good pictures for them while they're out there, just enjoying the moment and with fish. And I really hate taking dock shots or whatever, where sometimes it will, if there's a bunch of kids and stuff like that, because they want to show all their friends. But just being able to capture that moment and having that memory is like, hey, I remember when we caught that fish, or we seen that snake or bird or whatever. And we were just up in Missouri hunting at Christmas at my mother-in-law's, her farm up there. And I took my kids. Every time I went out, I had one of them with me. And it started snowing, and I told my daughter, I said, the snow's getting ready to start. I said, all these birds are probably going to come out and start feeding right when it does, before it covers the ground. And I mean, it was like clockwork, flakes started coming out of the sky, and the diversity up there is insane. I mean, we've seen probably 15, 20 different species of birds in like 20 minutes. Yep. And just, we're up in the trees, basically in a box blind or surrounded by all this, and they're just landing on the branches right next to us. And I mean, we've seen so much cool stuff. And my favorite growing up was always the Eastern bluebird. And we finally had one of those show up. And so she got to see that. And, awesome. And it was pretty cool, getting to see stuff like that. Normally you wouldn't see, where we live now.
Yeah. But you don't get that here in Southeast Texas.
Yeah.
But we do, however, have an incredible bird migration, down here. And, I was always against birding. It's kind of like a joke in the herping community, never to become a birder. And I kind of went with that for the longest time. I was like, man, it's kind of closed minded. So once I got a telephoto lens and I started going out, because my problem with birding, I guess, was they're so far away. I like to see the animals up close. I want to pick them up, or at least be able to observe them in close proximity. And then the bird thing, I'm just like, man, you just go out and look at birds. Well, it just doesn't seem that cool to me. The first time I went out during spring migration with my big super telephoto lens, and I'm taking pictures of, these really cool warblers and tanagers and orioles, I was blown away by the diversity of birds and just how beautiful they were. And the the migration itself is fascinating. A lot of these birds, when they get here to the Texas coast, they just flew, you know, across the Gulf of Mexico from Central and South America, and they make this trek every year, mm-hmm. that, you know, there and back, spring, you know, in the spring and the fall. And it's just, it's incredible. So I'm not a full-time birder, but when there's birds migrating, I'd like to get out and see them. And I encourage people to, because it is, I mean, people travel from all over the world to Galveston and Sabine Pass and these locations, High Island, people from Europe and all these places in the world come here to Southeast Texas to see these birds. And most of the locals, and even when I was, you know, younger, I never knew that we had this incredible wildlife spectacle right here in Southeast Texas. Yeah, birds are cool, man. Birds are cool.
Yeah, they're definitely neat animals, and we definitely, I see that when I'm out working and stuff. You'll see people taking pictures, and especially like on the dike, and when we're up at like Annawike National Wildlife Refuge working and stuff, or man, even being out on our shrimp boat at work, we'll be out in the Gulf pulling nets and stuff, and we'll be offshore, and you'll have these little birds just landing on the boat, and they just look so exhausted. They'll just sit on the front of the boat for like an hour, and then they'll just take off. So
I've seen the pictures of that. It's crazy. I think it usually happens when it's when they're migrating back north and they hit a north wind, and they're like screwed. You know, they have
like there's nowhere to land.
I mean, there's nowhere to land, so they just land on oil rigs and you know, fishing boats.
Yeah,
we'll see that in real time. I've only ever seen the pictures, but
yeah. Well, we need to get you to come over here and go out with us sometime. That'd be fun.
I've got experience fishing, you know, Sabine Lake and Galveston Bay, and I've done a lot of redfish and speck fishing growing up here, flounder fishing. I've never gone out very far. I've never done a true offshore fishing trip.
Yeah, we need to get you and Chester and y'all go out with us on one of our shark tagging trips something. Man, that'd be a lot of fun. Get out and see some of that firsthand. So, and actually, I mean, we go to Sabine usually once or twice a year too. So, I mean, we could even just do it right there. So, run down to Pleasure Island, hop on the boat.
I'd love that. My experience with all that is very limited, and I'm just saving it for a time in life after I get done with everything.
Yeah, right.
Like coral reefs. Like I don't think much about coral reefs, and you know, a lot of people that are into nature, they got to go explore a coral reef, and I'm like, I'm saving that for like way down the road, because I have way more important stuff to do on land first before I explore those waters. There's so much.
You don't have to go to Florida. I mean, we have the Flower Garden Bank here, which is about 85 miles out of Galveston. And I don't dive, but I mean, I know there's a lot of people that go out there, do dive trips and stuff. And most people don't even know that's here.
Is that,
you know, and it's really cool area.
Is there ecotourism surrounding that? Like
there is some. I mean, it's a National Marine Sanctuary. So there's certain boats that'll go out and take people out specifically just to dive and photograph and film it and stuff. And everything you can imagine is out there. I mean, just looking at some of the videos I've seen that have been shot out there and stuff, it's pretty crazy. And some really good fishing around it too, certain times of year. I mean, it's like probably the number one wahoo spawning migration area in the Gulf is right there on the flower gardens. So,
you know, I never even knew the flower gardens existed until deep in the heart.
Really?
Yeah. My first time seeing the flower gardens, and that the way they filmed it was really incredible. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I never knew that we had a coral reef so close.
Yeah. Yeah. So that brings up an interesting point. So, I mean, we were talking before we even started, just kind of, this is a cool industry to be a part of, right?
Right.
Fishing and hunting, conservation world, and it's very small. And most people see it on TV and just like, oh, it's like, you know, this is so big, like I'll never. And it's you know, I can just say, like, I've met a lot of these people I idolized growing up on TV now, and they're just normal people that got lucky and got a job doing what they love, and we've. Me and you both have got to work with some incredible individuals and stuff. Kind of talk about the networking side of being in the outdoors industry and what that's done for you.
Sorry, man. I got a text just now. I got to I might have to go catch crocodiles. We got a cold snap and some of the crocs are still out.
Oh man.
I stay connected to some of the people I worked for. But yeah, the networking has been incredible. You know, my experience in this field is when I think about it, it's all the highlights are mainly the wildlife encounters and the cool work I've been involved with, but often overlook the people, man. I've met so many cool people, and that, you know, that adds so much value to it. I made such good friends and I have so many great mentors. I've been lucky, but I've been very calculated in how I've been networking, and most young wildlife professionals are going to use a LinkedIn and you know, the more normal professional avenues to stay mm-hmm. connected. But man, I've developed this network of people from the time I was 13 or 14 through Facebook and Instagram until now. And then people, like, most of my jobs I've had, you know, professional jobs and otherwise, came from just friendships I've made along the way on through Instagram. And, yeah. You know, there's all these great naturalists that I look up to here in Texas. And, you know, when they finally, you know, invite me out to go herping or birding or, you know, looking for rare plants or whatever, I get to, you know, learn from them and show them just how passionate I am. And that's kind of been an important part of my career, creating job opportunities, is really connecting with people on a personal level, mm-hmm. Getting out there in the field and you know, really showing people that you're serious. But I've also had random opportunities too. Like, I mentioned deep in the heart, when I was in college, I got hired to just work as a biologist on the film when they came out to East Texas, just random. And I hadn't even graduated college yet. But I just, you know, I'd spent so much time in this particular region in Texas, and there's way more qualified people that probably should have been looped in on that. But, the director of the film just appreciated my passion for this particular area and hired me to work for him on that. And, it was incredible, man. It was one of the coolest things I will ever do in my life, is having been able to work alongside Ben Masters and all the people from Fin and Fur Productions, for like two whole years. It was like this major highlight, and it like just brought me immense happiness and value, because mm-hmm. that film was really incredible. It moved a lot of people, and it was just, you know, one of a kind experience getting involved with it.
Yeah. It seeing it for the first time, you know, in the movie theaters and stuff with my kids' reaction to it were just priceless. I even told Ben, you know, some of the reactions that my boy had, you know, with the footage of the snakes, you know, searching for the bats and the cactus and that kind of thing. And just incredible, and such a unique way to get people more aware of wildlife in Texas specifically. But I mean, you know, it's get more involved in wherever they're at, you know, in the country or the world. And Ben does such a good job bringing people together and creating mm-hmm. such good quality work. I mean, I know they're working on a lot of new stuff right now, which I can't tell you how excited I am to see some of it. So, it's going to be cool to see what comes out, and hopefully you get to participate in some of that going forward. And no telling.
I got a great text recently, but I can't say much about it.
well, that's all right.
There's some good stuff. There's some good stuff, and I'm very grateful for my connection to that. And it's not, I never really imagined ever being involved with cinematography or filmmaking and all that. But, you know, after Deep in the Heart came in, I realized just how important that stuff can be. And when it comes to moving the needle, because we have the research, we have the biology, we have, you know, the Texas Parks and Wildlife is fantastic. But reaching the broader public is ultimately a very important mission. Yeah. And,
It's the hardest mission, in my opinion.
And getting people to kind of rally around certain ideals in such a diverse landscape of, you know, ideas that people have, just getting people to unite around conservation in general. It seems like such an easy sell, but it is still hard. But a film like Deep in the Heart, I feel like it really helped bring all sorts of different people together, you know, in the name of one singular mission. So yeah, it's very inspiring and just
really doesn't hurt to have Matthew McConaughey narrating either. I mean, that's pretty iconic in itself.
But when I learned that he was narrating, I was like, oh, and this is just the icing on the cake now. This is what needed to happen. Iconic, such an iconic Texan.
Yeah. That was awesome. I remember asking Ben, like, what was that like getting the response back from his camp, you know? And he's like, he said he's interested in it. Let's go.
Yeah. It's incredible. I've watched the film so many times that each time it's still inspiring. Mm-hmm. And you'll see I've seen other states kind of getting similar work done. In Florida, they had a Path of the Panther, mm-hmm. a similar wildlife cinematography. I haven't seen it, but I'm assuming it's somewhat similar. So it seems like wildlife cinematography is really about to explode, which is great.
Yeah, the movie quality is not there anymore. I know that. So it's definitely time to see something. And that was the cool thing about that, because I think when it came out on the theatrical run, I mean, they were only predicting to have a couple weeks of being out, and it stayed out like all summer.
Yeah, it was for months.
It was like topping Top Gun 2 in places, and it was pretty incredible. So that was cool that you got to be a part of that, man. I know that had to be awesome.
It was awesome. So very, very grateful.
Yep. So, well, coming to what we're doing now, kind of what made you decide to jump into, I mean, you have your own podcast, kind of tell us about that and kind of what was the motivation to get that started?
How it happened was, I was talking to one of my wildlife friends, over video chat, and, someone I hadn't met in real life. It was like their Instagram. Right. And, mm-hmm. I was kind of like just naturally interviewing him because like we have the shared passion and something. Yep. And we're just chatting about wildlife. And I was like, man, I need to start a podcast. And then I went on my friend's podcast, and, I was actually very surprised at how comfortable I was doing it. I thought I was gonna be really nervous. Podcasting was such an intimidating thought. Especially for me, I grew up pretty crippling social anxiety, and I was very shy and whatnot, but I realized that I have a pretty confident voice in this format. Really, I learned that pretty quick when I went on another podcast, and I was like, man, I need to do this. So I just thought of a name and just started interviewing some of my favorite wildlife friends, and I was real consistent at first. I was doing, one a week, two a week. I was just banging them out.
Yep.
But that's not sustainable in the long run. So,
it's tough. It's the hardest part about it is staying consistent.
It is. And I don't put the pressure myself for the longest time. I did. I was like, I got to do one a week at least. That's easy enough. Or now, and then I'd switch it to, two a month. And, I'll sometimes go a few months without doing one, but that's okay, man. I do this for fun. And I do it when I feel like doing it.
Yeah.
And have a guest that I really want to talk to. So my expectations aren't the same as when I started. When I started, I thought, I need to post every week and really put the effort in, but it's turned into something I just thoroughly enjoy doing. And if it grows naturally, that's great too. Mm-hmm. But I've met some great people, and it's been great to give people a voice. I'm really partial to people that are kind of like me, that are just kind of low key and shy. And I try to give those people a comfortable platform to talk about their passions. Because there's so many influencers out there and people that are naturally extroverted and people great people. But I like to hear what everybody has to say. And try to keep the guests pretty diverse. It's called the Wildlife Experience. And that's a pretty broad thing. I've always been just very interested in how people interact with the natural world, because mm-hmm. I grew up doing all this different stuff, hunting, fishing, herping, birding. And one of my main passions now is like looking for plants, like rare plants. And that's just very random, but it's nature. All aspects of nature are very captivating to me. So I have all these different avenues of people to reach. And it's been very cool, man. I really enjoy it. So I'll have hunters on, I'll have botanist on. I'll have birders, ornithologists, biologists, really anybody that has anything to say or any stories to share about their experiences in nature. And always trying to keep the theme of conservation at kind of at the forefront. That's how it's going, man. And I think I'm up to a little over 30 episodes now. I'm hopeful this year I'll do a lot. Last year I was a little slow. I'm really kind of starting to settle into my current job and my current living situation. And I think this year I'll be doing a lot more, nice. A lot more recording.
Nice. Yeah. My wife loves watching when you post anything about plants and stuff, cause she's a botanist and stuff. So that's always cool to see. And what little botany I know, I enjoyed getting to do, you know, it was one of the things that we kind of bonded over when we were, you know, together initially is she was working on a research project in the Ozarks over in Eastern Oklahoma. And so she was doing a floristic inventory of some U.S. Fish and Wildlife property that was over there on the border near Poteau, Oklahoma. And we would travel up there and we would just walk through the woods and document any flowering plant we could find. And I couldn't tell you how many timber rattlers we almost stepped on and copperheads and just all kinds of crazy stuff. And I remember just the random experiences you have being outdoors. I mean, one day we sat down to eat lunch out in the middle of the forest and we're just sitting there on these logs and we're like, what is that noise? And we look up and there's a whole flock of turkeys roosted in the tree in the middle of the day above us. I'm like, what are they doing in the trees this time of day? And they never made a sound. I mean, they were just pieces of wood and stuff falling down on us. And we look up and there's like 20 birds sitting up there. But, you know, it's just like you're never going to get experiences like that if you don't get out and enjoy it. So but that's cool, man. I mean, you do a really good job with the podcast. You ask some really good questions and really bring out the best in your guests. And that was kind of when I started. Like, I was introverted in my mind growing up and very shy. I mean, I didn't talk to a lot of people, and my parents say I do, but you know, I was really nervous about starting it out, but kind of the same thought, you know, it's like I've met all these cool people, you know, and I like sharing people's stories now. This is kind of just naturally the next step. And there was people telling me, it's like, why do you want to start a podcast? Everybody has a podcast, you know, why do you want to start one? And I was like, well, I want to try to help make a difference and get people that you may have never heard of out. You know, and that's kind of the basis that came out of forming the summit, of starting the summit, was trying to get people's voices heard about things. And initially with that, and you were there from the second and third year, you know, it was initially I seen this as more of like a hunting and fishing thing, and it's turned into something a little bit different in a good way, and really focusing on conservation. And mentorship has kind of come to the forefront out of almost every episode that's recorded at this event every year. And that's been pretty cool to see that grow and see the people that have been involved with it grow and change and, you know, and become, you know, what they are today. I mean, Paul's completely, our friend Paul Fazinski from Aptitude. I mean, he's almost completely changed his approach to podcasting and stuff just since we've met him. And it's really cool to see that happen, you know, and
that's one of my favorite parts of the summit is the people, obviously. You know, Paul is one of the coolest people I've ever met in my, you know, my time working with wildlife. And, you know, I got there because of Chester, and Chester, you know, he's from over my corner of the state. He was a bit of a mentor for me when I was growing up out here. And just the fellowship there and the just getting out there and hanging out and going fishing and you know, getting some podcast, you know, getting some episodes pumped out. It really is an amazing experience. And I'm very sad to say, I already told you, but I will be absent this year. I'm going to the Amazon.
Oh, darn.
it was a kind of an impulsive decision to go. I just, my friends are going down I'd had an opportunity to go, and it's kind of a lifelong goal of mine is go to the Amazon. So I was just like, man, I just need to do it now, get it over with. Yep. Maybe I'll never go back, check it off. But, anyway, yeah, I'll miss this year. I'm sad about it, but I will definitely be there next year. And you know, I just, and it's at the Warren Ranch, you know, just beautiful ranch up there in the hills.
It's pretty incredible. My vision was to end up there at the Warren Ranch, you know, and the first year we held it at a friend's ranch, and it was just kind of like a proof of concept, I guess, to see if this would actually even work. And the format completely changed from the first year to the way it is now. It's a lot of fun. I mean, I work all year on that 4 days, trying to get that 4 days to come together.
Everybody's involved in it. We appreciate it. I appreciate it. The first time I went, I was so nervous.
I remember.
I was so nervous. When Chester asked me, I was like, man, I don't know if this is my thing. You know, y'all are all like seasoned podcasters.
Yeah, right.
Just over here doing my little online gig. And I get there, everybody's so down to earth. And I met you and everybody else. And I was like, all right, these are a solid group of people. And I'm sad. I'm not going this year now that we're talking about it.
Well, you can try to zoom in one night and say hi to everybody.
I think I'll have Wi-Fi at one of the, we traveling around, staying different camps and lodges. I think one of the lodges has Wi-Fi, so maybe I'll call in.
It's been cool. It's been a cool experience, and I know there's been a lot of work on some documentaries that we've filmed at the summit with Paul and Seth and Chester, and I know you were part of one of them. We premiered that last year, and I'm not sure when that's getting released. I know they're still trying to work on getting that into some film festivals this year
See the whole thing.
I'm excited about that, and we've got two more that we're premiering at this year's event. So I've seen both of those and they're really good. So I'm excited for people to get to see those that are there. And, you know, it's like, I feel like I have to apologize to everybody's girlfriends and husbands or whatever, whoever's there, for getting them involved in this. Cause it's just kind of one big rabbit hole that's with a bunch of others leading out of it and stuff, but that's what it's for. I mean, networking is such an important part of anything you do in life if you're going to be successful. And this has just turned into one of the best events that I know of in the industry to do that. So
it's something I look forward to every year. And from here on out, it's a non-negotiable. That is on my calendar. I don't know why when I was scheduling my Amazon trip, I thought my dates were good, but anyhow, I'll look to next year.
Yeah. You can double check. Something happens. You always got a seat table. So, what are, you know, you're talking about, talk a little bit about Sure Shot and stuff and what you're doing there right now.
Man, this is one of the most random opportunities life has thrown at me. I never imagined running the oldest duck call company in the United States. A couple of years back, I guess it was about 2 years ago, I met the new owner, Jay Bruce. You know, passionate baseball fans might know his name. He played 14 years in the MLB. He was a 2-time All-Star, Silver Slugger, like a really great ball player. Mm-hmm. Played for a lot of different teams. Last team he played for was the Yankees. He retired in 2020, and he moved back here to Beaumont. And he just bought Sure Shot. He just bought this whole duck call company. Something fun to do now that he's, you know, 37 and retired, or however old he is, pretty young to be retired. I went hunting with him on his ranch. I guess it was in 2020, right after he bought it. And, man, we really clicked. And, anytime I meet somebody like that, you know, I always try to, you know, make a good impression, cause you just never know. I never really would have thought I would have any connection to anything he did. But lo and behold, about a year and a half later, he texted me, to see what I'm up to with my career and if I'm enjoying my job. And the thing was, I was enjoying consulting. I was working for a really cool consulting firm in Houston, really cool boss. And the work itself was great, but I will say the kind of the living in, you know, the suburbs of Houston and you know, going into an office most days, I could see the projection of where my life was going to go. I would end up, you know, a domesticated, you know, urbanite pretty quickly. And that wasn't
will drive you crazy over here.
I belong in the woods out here in Finette. And so I'd moved back here and I was commuting to Tomball 3 times a week, hour and a half drive. And it wasn't the best situation. So when Jay texted me, I was like, man, I'll give that a shot. I don't know nothing about business. I'm one of the least business savvy people there is. I'm a naturalist. I think of the world in ecological terms, not economic. But you know, I've actually come to really enjoy running this place, and I didn't really know what I was getting myself into. I thought I was, you know, going to come in here and take pictures and tune calls, because it's something I've always been interested in is duck calling. I've competed before, and so I thought, you know, tune calls and you know, run the social media. But I was being hired to run this thing, and now I'm currently the only full time employee here. Wow. I have a couple part timers that come in, some high school kids that help out, and someone that helps out with the storefront. But over the past year, I've really had to learn kind of the ins and outs of running a business. And the good thing is, it's, you know, we're selling duck calls. It's not that big of a deal. You know, it's very easy generally. But we do work with some of the biggest outdoor stores in the country, you know, Max Prairie Wings and Roger Sporting Goods. And I have to maintain some professionalism. But for the most part, man, I get to have a lot of fun up here. I get to blow duck calls every day. I hunt a lot during the week, you know, during the season.
Product testing.
a lot of product testing, and I've designed a few duck calls. We have a gadwall call coming out, and that's been really cool. And it's really allowed me in the off season, you know, because duck season's only from, you know, November through January, and the rest of the time there's not a whole lot to do around here. You know, our online sales kind of start to plateau off in January, and by the time we get to March and April, we're kind of in our off season and trying to tune, get our inventory built back up. And I get a lot of off time, so I've been able to, you know, get involved with some cool wildlife work. And kind of the flexibility this job gives me is really why I took it. And that's, you know, when I was first getting hired, you know, Jay, he's always been interested in the wildlife stuff that I do. He follows me on Instagram, and he's sees how passionate I am. And, you know, he assured me that I could still pursue my wildlife passion working here. You know, it's kind of a get stuff done type of schedule. You know, it's not super intensive. So the lifestyle I've been able to live working here has been excellent. And I may never go back to wildlife biology. We'll see. I kind of enjoy working in this industry, but who knows? Every year is different. Time goes by quick, but so far it's been great. And I take my role here very seriously. I want to represent Sure Shot. You know, Sure Shot's a household name throughout the South. If you're, you know, come from a waterfowling family, been around since the 1950s. It's the oldest still running duck call company. Most of those companies back in the 50s are, you know, basically gone now. So it's got a really rich history and heritage in the waterfowl world. And it's kind of an honor to work here. I get to meet a lot of cool people. I really enjoy it. I've never imagined working at running a duck call shop, but it's one of the coolest things I've ever done.
Well, one of these days you're going to have to teach me how to blow a duck call, because I've got a few, but I don't duck hunt that much, so I really have no idea what I'm doing. But listening to you and seeing some of the videos you've done is it's impressive how effective calls are. I mean,
yeah, it really is.
You know, there's not, I mean, turkey hunting, like, I can't blow a diaphragm call to save me. I just gag all the time. But, you know, I love box calls, slate mm-hmm. calls and stuff, and utilizing those. And it's so cool being able to interact with an animal.
Yep.
What's that one?
This is one of the old, this is a Jensen from probably the 90s. I've gotten pretty good at aging these things. Like, sometimes people will bring them in from, you can tell they're from like the 60s or 70s. Mm-hmm. This one's probably from the 80s or 90s. But this is kind of the call that started the company. It's got the double reed in there. Cowboy Fernandez really put Sure Shot on the map with this call when he won the 1959 World Championship duck calling contest in Stuttgart. Mm-hmm. It was him, and it was a guy named George Jensen. I think George is really the one that designed the call, but when Cowboy won the World Championship with it, that's when Sure Shot became a, you know, the top notch business. you know, so
yeah. You gonna give us a demo with that one?
I can. I sure can.
Let's hear it.
This is one of the old ones. I don't know how it's tuned. Call's like probably 30, 40 years old, and it still runs. Still sounds like a duck.
Yeah, it must have been loud because it kind of blacked out the sound.
Yeah, I don't know how that came out on the audio, but it was worth a shot.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool, though, man.
We also have Redbone, not to interrupt you, but we're actually two companies now. Redbone Goose Calls is our other company, and that's a custom, you know, world champion winning spec call.
Mm.
That's another thing we're doing now.
Yeah. And how's the duck season been this year over where you're at?
It's been rough. Now my friends that are still running out to the public land, you know, working hard to hunt the marsh out at McFett, you know, different refuges along the Texas coast. They've been doing well. You know, usually I'm out there with them, but for some reason this year I haven't been super motivated to get out and sit at the boat ramp from, you know, 10 p.m. all the way till 4 p.m. and then boating out and spending a whole night in the marsh, which is what it takes out there on the public land. You got to get out there the night before, just to get a spot in line. And I've had some opportunities to hunt, you know, easier stuff. So I've been doing that, but, it's been rough though. You know, we haven't had our migration's been kind of slow. There's not a whole lot of ducks around. It's hard to explain. I never know what to, there's so many variables.
It seems like we've had a little influx of snow geese over here, close to my area. Cause I mean, some of the people at work, I guess, took a picture and sent to us on GroupMe of a bunch of snow geese, and which we haven't really seen a lot in the last few years. I mean, you know, the flyways changed so much,
right?
over the last however many years, but
about 20 years it's really been drastic.
Yeah, it's probably put some people out of business, just, you know, the number of outfitters that were over here, you know, in the Katy Prairie and going south towards El Campo and all that area and stuff. But there's still a lot of people hunting in that in that area and stuff. So
my buddy, he's a professor at McNeese. His name is Mark Merchant. He's a pretty renowned biologist. He's a passionate duck hunter. He hunts some of the same stuff. We do a lot of hunting together. He was telling me about the legislation that was passed in 1999, I think, that legalized flooding corn up in the up north, the upper part of the Mississippi and the Prairie Pothole region, the northern states.
Yeah.
And when they legalized that, that's when the downward trend of wintering populations in the south started occurring.
Yeah.
So it's, I always thought, you know, perhaps it was the weather, or, you know, who knows? I was always kind of open-minded.
No, it was us.
It was the people up north stealing
human interaction, you know, and you see more and more of that now. I mean, all the stuff that, like, they're dealing with over in Florida with the algal blooms, you know, and Okeechobee and stuff that Captains for Clean Water is fighting, and the stuff here. I mean, just the population growth alone in Texas, if people would stop coming here, which I can't say anything because I'm from Oklahoma, but I've been here for 20
years.
So
you're a good Texan, Texas immigrant.
But
you know, the thing is, we still have such large expanses in the West and, you know, even in the East. It just sucks for, you know, I became very interested in the Katy Prairie ecosystem after I worked there. I worked for the Texas A&M Natural Resource Institute when I was in college doing research on chicken turtles. It's a really rare species of turtle that lives in these prairies. And I became really interested in that prairie ecosystem. And, man, every time I go back out there, there's more of it gone. It really... all the areas around Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, Austin, they're going to get chewed up. But I guess the good thing is the development's got to stop at some point because people don't want to get too far away from the urban centers, you know, the downtown and all that. So hopefully, you know, most of our Central Texas hills will remain under ranch, you know, ranch land and wildlife use and stay pretty rural. South, you know, Southwest Texas, most of South Texas, West Texas. I think we should be fine, but it is crazy how many people have moved here. And for the longest time, I would think about it way too much, but I try to remain optimistic these days.
Yeah. I mean, when we moved down here, and as I said, just 20 years ago, next month, basically, we bought in the town we're in because it was so separated from everything. And now it's basically from Houston all the way to Galveston. There's no empty spots left on the interstate.
And that's a lot that's been very recent too, just over the past 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah. It happens really fast, but there's always so much construction going on. It's like by the time this project gets done, it's going to be time to replace it, you know, because it's not going to be adequate enough. So, there's one other thing I wanted to chat with you about before we get off. You just mentioned while ago getting that text, but kind of talk a little bit about alligators and the crocs and stuff you worked with and why. I mean, why that happens? Why do you have to go out and remove these things? I mean,
yeah.
They show up in your backyard, you know, that kind of thing. So what's up with those?
So my interest in alligators and crocodiles in general started when I was pretty young, you know, watching Steve Irwin growing up. And I was born down here in Southeast Texas, but for like about half of my childhood, I lived north of Dallas where we didn't have alligator populations and there are some up there, but not very many. When I moved back down here when I was in like middle school or high school, I was so excited to be back in alligator country, and I immediately started going out looking for them and trying to get as close as I can and observe them. And I eventually got my nuisance alligator permit when I turned 18 and started catching alligators for Texas Parks and Wildlife as like a sort of like a contractor.
Right.
There's so many alligator calls and Parks and Wildlife can't do it all. So they rely heavily on us, and I still do it now. It's just there's so many alligators now. We've done a really good job of bringing alligator populations back to a sustainable level. We have a great alligator season here, but as these cities keep expanding, especially around Houston, where people are moving into historic alligator habitat, and they call us. They're like, an alligator has invaded my property. I'm like, it was the other way around.
Yeah, right.
And these days I try to put some effort into talking landowners into letting the alligator leave itself. Cause usually it's like the most common situation is this. It's about a 3 to 5 foot male. It got pushed out during breeding season, ended up in a canal or in someone's pond. It's not even there to eat anything. And even if it wanted to, like, they're not that effective at catching bass, I don't think, which is the cherished, you know, game fish that most people are managing for in their ponds.
Yeah.
So I don't think they have a huge impact on the fish. And usually if you just leave it alone, it'll be gone on its own. Cause most of the time we catch these animals, we have to put them in captivity or you have to harvest them. And either way is fine. I haven't done any harvest. I've just enjoyed catching them and kind of giving them a second chance at life if I can. I have gone alligator hunting before during the season, but when it's not a season, I feel like it's only fair to at least try to give some of those animals that ended up in, just a bad spot, a chance to be relocated, or if not, put in a facility and used in an educational zoo or something. Preferably though, we want to keep alligators in the wild as best as we can, because, as more people move to Houston and Beaumont, these alligator human conflicts are going to increase. And, it's hard to imagine we'd ever see like a decline because of urban sprawl. But I mean, so many neighborhoods popping up, and we don't want a situation where alligators are only in the National Wildlife Refuge. We want alligators to be ever present in our lives. They're important culturally. We eat the alligator every year. I go to Gator Fest in Anahuac. That's a staple of the culture in Southeast Texas as Gator Fest. And we always want to keep alligators at the forefront of our culture here, and they're so important ecologically, and they're just awesome to look at. A lot of people that move in from other states or big cities, they They just view them as kind of like a direct threat to them or their pets or their family. And sometimes they
can't. Thinking of horror movies, you know, this thing's going to eat everything, attack us and stuff.
And it's usually not the case. I mean, they're so docile as long as you don't feed them and, you know, kind of keep your distance.
I think that's the key. The feeding part. That's a lot of people.
They are fed that, and one, they can be fed one time. And after that, they're done. Like they will come up to every human after that. I'll tell you what, most nuisance alligator calls I get are not alligators being fed. So they're not, in my mind, they're not really a nuisance. They're just an alligator that ended up in a bad, you know, in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I'd really like to be able to, with alligators like that, I think it'd be cool if we could release those back into the wild, but it's really hard. You know, it's kind of a subjective, thing, you know, with, but you can tell when alligator's been fed. They come right up to you. You don't even need to catch them on a hook. You can just rope them, you know. But it's great. It's something I do a lot in the spring and the summer, and it gets pretty busy. I do it for free. You know, I'll be driving all over the place catching these things. And I currently don't have a truck. I'm driving an SUV, so I got this little RAV4. So I'll have, you know, an 8-foot alligator crammed in there, and people get a real kick out of it. But get the job done.
Oh man, yeah, I usually get two or three calls a year from people that know me and know I work for the state, and so they'll be like, "There's an alligator here at my friend's house. Like, what do we do?" And I was like, "Well, send me the address, and I'll let the game wardens know or something, and we'll see what they can do." I mean, I had one friend; she sent me a picture here in Texas City. And there was like a 12, 13 footer just sitting on their porch, just sitting there. And I was like, well, that would probably get me too if I opened the door and seen that sitting there. So, but they got it and relocated it and stuff. But yeah, that's cool. I mean, it's cool to know that there's people out there that you can get a hold of. And, you know, where do people, as far as like what you do, being a licensed, having a nuisance, is it a nuisance license? Is that what you?
It's a nuisance alligator control permit.
Okay, so and you get that through the state.
Yep. John Warner, he's the alligator program leader. He does a class every couple of years, and you have to pay an annual, you know, permit fee, $250. And he really wants people that are going to be committed, that are doing it for the right reasons, and are interested in alligator management. Because you'll have some young dudes coming in there. They're looking for their next viral video and stuff like that. So, want to keep people that are, you know, just interested in alligators and their conservation. But
cool, man. Stuff. Well, Andrew, I appreciate it. And I know we both got stuff going on and stuff, so we can get off here, but, why don't you let everybody know where they can follow you? And on your stuff and with Sure Shot and all that, and where they can check out your podcast and everything.
So on Instagram, my username is The Texas Naturalist. It's kind of where I post a lot of my outdoor stuff, wildlife stuff. I share my podcast on there. I do have an Instagram account for my podcast. It's just The Wildlife Experience. My podcast is on Spotify and all the other avenues. I don't actually know how many avenues it's on, because I just post it to this RSS feed. It just like shoots it out. Spotify is the best place to listen, I think. And hopefully I'll be getting some new episodes out this year with some cool guests. That's about it, man. Really appreciate it. Really always enjoy chatting, man.
Glad we got to do this finally and stuff. And let's try to connect a little bit more this year and do some stuff outside of the summit and get together. I mean, we're not that far away from each other. So
even though I'm not going to the summit, if there's any way I can, you know, be help, be involved or anything, just keep me in touch.
Sounds good, man. All right. Well, I appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good, man.
All right.